Open them to John chapter 8. That's where we're going to pick up today. But also open them to Ephesians 3. I really only want to zero in on one verse here, but it's really hard to find a good place to jump in. So I'm going to read starting at the first verse until we get down to the relevant verse here. So here we are in Ephesians chapter 3. For this reason, I, Paul, the prisoner of Jesus Christ for you Gentiles, if indeed you've heard of the dispensation of the grace of God which was given to me for you, speaking to the Gentiles, how that by revelation he, that is the Lord, made known to me the mystery, and here's parentheses inside of parentheses, as I have briefly written already, by which, when you read, you may understand my knowledge in the mystery of Christ, which in other ages was not made known to the sons of men, as it has now been revealed by the Spirit to his holy apostles and prophets. All of that to say that the gospel that you're hearing was previously hidden until the current time, Paul's current time, where it was revealed to him and others by the Lord. That, and here's the essence of it, the Gentiles should be fellow heirs of the same body and partakers of his promise in Christ through the gospel, of which I became a minister according to the gift of the grace of God given to me by the effective working of his power. All of that to say that the Lord has revealed to me, says Paul, that this isn't just for the Jews. This isn't just for the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. This thing includes the Gentiles too. And if you put the Jews and the Gentiles together, what you end up with is everybody. So that's big news. To me, who am less than the least of all the saints, this grace was given that I should preach among the Gentiles the unsearchable riches of Christ and to make all see what is the fellowship of the mystery which from the beginning of the ages has been hidden in God who created all things through Jesus Christ. And here's the verse I really want you to get. To the intent, you know, all of that so that now the manifold wisdom of God might be made known by the church, that's us, to the principalities and powers in the heavenly places, that is in the spiritual, the invisible spiritual realm, according to the eternal purpose which he accomplished in Christ Jesus our Lord, in whom we have boldness and access with confidence through faith in him. Now back up a little bit to verse 10, you know, Paul is saying how thrilled he is to have received this gift of God, to be the messenger of this incredible, you know, the revealer of what was formerly a mystery that God has made a way to include everyone in his promises to rescue us from the consequences of sin. And verse 10, to the intent, you know, and so he says part of the purpose of all of that, the intention of all of that, is that now the manifold wisdom of God, you know, the unsearchable riches of God's wisdom might be made known by the church, by Jesus' followers, by his disciples, to the principalities and powers in the heavenly places. And so when you read between the lines, the only conclusion you can come to is this, that as all of this, you know, there's an invisible creation that we just don't see or hear or our five senses can't perceive for a variety of reasons that are really a fascinating study when you get into the science of matter and, you know, string theory and quantum physics and you know, the reality that in lead, which is the densest material known, you know, to man, there's actually more space in lead in between the molecules than there is space that's taken up by the molecules, which opens up this whole theoretical possibility that there are other, you know, and it sounds kind of science fiction-like, other parallel universes or parallel existences that are actually not, you know, out there somewhere, but right here, right now, just taking up space, you know, other than the space that we're in. And part of that whole thing, it seems a really likely explanation anyway, is this the realm of the spirit world, angels and demons and a whole nother created order, and that's important, created by God just as we are. There's this whole other realm out there, and that other realm, that spiritual realm, they're watching. They kind of stand back and they watch, and there was nothing, and then God spoke, and then there was something, and it was good, and the weeks of creation go by, and then there's man and woman and reproduction and family and a population and languages and wars and peace, and history unfolds, in this really incredible story since the first day. And all those spiritual beings kind of look at this and go, what in the world is God up to? I mean, he created these people, these humans, these weird little animals that walk upright, and he put them in this paradise, and they just kind of went, and, we're going to do our own thing. And God didn't just wipe them out. He said, well, go ahead. I'm going to fix this. All the way back in Genesis 3:15 is the first hint that God says, I'm going to take care of this. I'm going to fix this problem. And history unfolds, and they're all going, just think through all the tribal wars and, the whole thing about in Europe, prior to America's existence, there were nations and conquering nations with just this brutal warfare and primitive weapons and just cruelty that's unimaginable. And we get into kind of the modern era, the mechanized era, and World War I and World War II and the Korean conflict, the Vietnam War, and all the way up to Desert Storm and Shock and Awe and, Norman, what's his name? Schwarzkopf, thank you, and everybody else, Petraeus, and this sort of up to the modern day. And the other than human realm kind of look and say, why does God put up with these people? Why does God put up with this mess? And all the while, God just kind of sits back and he's kind of, twiddled his thumbs. He's just going, you just watch. You just watch how this is going to work out. And this passage in Ephesians tells us that it's going to be the church that reveals God's manifold wisdom to these principalities and powers so that when the time comes and it's the last day, all these spiritual principalities and powers are going to kind of look at each other and go, can you believe that? Can you believe what he did? How he turned this mess and we couldn't figure out what the heck is he going to do with this deal? And he's flipped it around to not only be okay, not only kind of fix it, but now it's better than we ever thought it could be. And now we see how from day one this plan's been unfolding just like God wanted it to until we get to the end of it when it's just kind of this, ta-da, here's what I'm doing. And they're all just going to go, oh, man, God is even smarter and wiser and kinder and more loving and more merciful and more gracious and more this and more everything than we ever, dared to imagine. And all of that, it gets to be revealed through us, through the church. Here in these last verses of John 8, we find Jesus indirectly referring to that idea, to that concept, that everything that has ever happened, is happening, or ever will happen, is the process of God doing something wonderful. So wonderful that not just mankind, but every created being of every realm, visible, invisible, and beyond, is just going to say, oh, we'll probably be speechless, actually. I just never imagined anything as wonderful as this. But you got to ask, what about tragedies? Something wonderful? Are you kidding me? Tragedies, world wars and personal loss. What we have to remember about that is that we live in a sin-infected world. And that sin infection causes great suffering and great pain. But, sometimes the Lord allows awful things to happen to us so that we will finally turn to him. I know that's my story. You know, God let me just destroy myself to the point where I didn't want to live. I didn't want to wake up. I didn't want to face the day. It was beyond pointless and hopeless. It was so painful, I just didn't want to be a part of it. When I finally turned to him, as a very last resort, I still remember my first prayer began with the words, God, if you're even there. And when I finally turned to him, though, guess what? There he was. He was right there waiting for me where he'd been waiting for me to stop spinning my wheels and flapping my wings. And it took a long time, a really long time. But I did finally reach the point where I became thankful for the pain that forced me to turn to him. Now, can we just get started? You know, we could have done it 20 years ago, but you didn't. But can we now just get started? Now, Romans tells us that even the earth itself, you know, the creation itself groans waiting for the day when God's purposes are accomplished and sin and suffering are no more. See, it's not just you and it's not just me who kind of get fed up or burned out, tired of hurting or struggling or whatever. You know, you just begin to get ahead and somebody pulls the rug out from under you, or you just slip, or a lot of time you just make a mistake. You trip yourself up. And it's not just us, it's the very planet itself. I mean, the dirt, the rocks, you know, the mantle, the layers, the core, the whole planet itself just groans, Romans tells us, waiting for that time when God's purposes are accomplished, and then we see what a wonderful thing God's been working on all this time. Now, before we get into the text here, we really need to kind of remind ourselves of the context of what's going on here. We've been going through in chapter 6 and 7 what really are a series of snippets, little scenes, from a variety of different conversations that Jesus had with the people who were considered to be the most connected with God of all. And in those conversations, Jesus tells them that they're not really connected to God at all, as do most religious people. They chose to argue and fight rather than just take a moment and let go of their presuppositions and listen to what the Lord is really saying. And it would be my prayer this morning that by the time we're through, everyone will have ears to hear what the Lord is saying. So let's read starting in John 8, verse 48 to the end of the chapter. And we'll catch up with the context in a minute, but this is the passage we're going to look at in detail this morning. It says, then the Jews answered. Remember, these are the Jewish religious leaders, not just the nation, the, you know, people born of Jewish descent, but a very specific group of people. And they said to him, do we not rightly say that you're a Samaritan and have a demon? And Jesus answered, I do not have a demon, but I honor my Father, and you dishonor me. And I don't seek my own glory. There's one who seeks and judges. Most assuredly, I say to you, if anyone keeps my word, he shall never see death. You imagine hearing that for the first time? What kind of a nutcase? And you can tell, look at their response. The Jews say to him, now we know you have a demon. You know, now we know you're out of your mind. Abraham is dead and the prophets, and you say, if anyone keeps my word, he shall never taste death. Are you greater than our father Abraham, who is dead, and the prophets are dead? Who do you make yourself out to be? You know, who do you think you are? And Jesus answered, if I honor myself, my honor is nothing. It's my Father who honors me, of whom you say he is your God. Yet you haven't known him, but I know him. And if I say I don't know him, I'll be a liar like you. But I do know him, and I keep his word. Your father Abraham rejoiced to see my day, and he saw it and was glad. And then the Jews said to him, "You are not yet 50 years old, and have you seen Abraham?" And Jesus said, "Most assuredly, I say to you, before Abraham was, I am." Then they took up stones to throw at him, you know, to kill him. But Jesus hid himself and went out of the temple, going through the midst of them, and so passed by. Not the first time he's had to do that. Okay, let's back up here and dive into this thing. Because God is doing something wonderful, to God be the glory. Since God is doing something wonderful, then he's the one to be glorified by it. Now, Jesus had just said, as if this weren't enough, he had just said some pretty harsh things. Back up to verse 38. "I speak what I've seen with my father, and you do what you've seen with your father." And they said, "Abraham is our father," you know, our forefather, through which or because of which we have this, you know, we're automatically followers, not fans. And Jesus said, "Well, if you were Abraham's kids, you'd do what Abraham did. But now you seek to kill me, a man who's told you the truth, which I heard from God. Abraham didn't do that. You do the deeds of your father." And they said to him, "We weren't born of fornication. We have one father, God." And Jesus said, "Well, if God were your father, you'd love me, for I came from him. I haven't come of myself. You know, he sent me. That's why I'm here, because he sent me. Why don't you understand my speech? It's because you're not able to listen to my word. You're of your father, the devil, and the desires of your father you want to do. He was a murderer from the beginning." He knew that their intent was to kill him, murder him. "And he doesn't stand in the truth because there's no truth in him. When he speaks a lie, he speaks of his own resources, or a better way, he speaks his native language. For he is a liar and the father of lies. But because I tell you the truth, you don't believe me. Which of you convicts me of sin?" Talk about an open door. "Which of you convicts me of sin?" Oh, if they just had one little thing to throw in his face, they would have been all over him right there, but they had nothing, and he knew they had nothing. And, you know, "You can't convict me of sin. I'm not a liar. And if I tell you the truth, then why don't you believe me? He who's of God hears God's words. Therefore, you don't hear because you're not of God." And that's when they said, "Do we not rightly say you are a Samaritan and a demon?" Man, Jesus said some pretty harsh things, and they come back with him to him with the harshest thing they can think of. Now, when they say you're a Samaritan and have a demon, probably the easiest understanding of Samaritan would be half-breed. That's who the Samaritans were. When the last tribe of the Jews was, we're talking hundreds of years before this time, when they were captured and taken captive, there were a few that got away, you know, out in the fields, hiding in the hills and so forth. And those ones that stayed behind ended up intermarrying with the non-Jewish, you know, native people of the land, because they were gone for quite a while. And so this whole other, this other tribe came up that was half Jewish and half, whether they were Philistines or whatever the native people were. And then, fast forward now, and the Jews are back, you know, in Jerusalem after Herod, who is himself only half Jewish, you know, in a Samaritan. But the king is really going to work on fixing the temple up and all that kind of thing. And they say, "You're a Samaritan. You're a half-breed. You know, you're not really a Jew. You're not one of us. You can't talk to us that way. Who do you think you are? You know, you can't even worship with us, let alone tell us how we're supposed to worship or what we should believe or what we should think." That's the common understanding, but here's a little clue that really sheds a special light on it. There's no recordings of Jesus speaking. You can't go buy the CD, you know, or even the cassette, 8-track, nothing. Most likely, Jesus spoke Aramaic. raised in a Jewish household. Aramaic was a form of, you know, it's kind of like Latin. There's Latin proper, and then there's all the other languages that are like Latin. And biblical Hebrew, you know, hadn't been spoken for a long, long time, had developed into what we now call Aramaic, very much like Hebrew, but not exactly Hebrew. But it was the common language of the Jews, and any little boy raised in a Jewish household was going to speak Aramaic as his first tongue. Now, it's highly likely that Jesus spoke and understood Koine Greek as well, but when Jews are talking to Jews, you're not going to talk the enemy's language, you're going to talk your own language, so he speaks in Aramaic. Now, in Aramaic, I can't pronounce it and I'm not going to try, but the word in Aramaic that would be translated into Samaritan doesn't have anything to do with that whole half-breed concept going back into the history of the Jews. But it literally means the chief of demons. So this is the worst insult they can come up with. I don't know if this is true, but somebody told me once that in Aramaic and in Hebrew, there are no swear words. You know, you can't call, that whole list of, you know, the seven deadly words that George Carlin discovered, you can't say, and all the other words, and don't think of them. And now that's all you're doing. I know, you're thinking of them. You can't help it. But apparently, and again, I can't confirm this, but apparently that whole, you know, genre of language isn't part of Hebrew or Aramaic. So the worst thing you could do would be to call somebody a dog. You dirty dog, you know, you cur, you filthy cur. I mean, that's as bad as it gets. To us, that's, you know, that's nothing compared to where we've learned how to go. But when they say, you're a Samaritan, you're the chief of demons, you know, that's just it. They can't think of anything worse to call him. Now, I have a theory about this, and it's just that. It's just my theory. It's not thus saith the Lord. It's not scientifically confirmed. But I think that the reason, when the language went from the Aramaic that Jesus most likely spoke to the Koine Greek in which the New Testament majority of the New Testament was written down and now finally translated into English, it's really hard a lot of times, and this is one of them, to get to the heart of what Jesus is saying. Now, unless you're really practiced at it, it's so easy. I mean, it's easy for me, and I've been at this a while, and I remember what it used to be like for me, to read some of these and just the order of the words and the way he says things, and you can read it and just go, I haven't the foggiest notion what he's getting at here. But I think that's for a reason. You know, I don't think that's a mistake or an accident of translation, you know, from two or three languages ago over a couple thousand years. I think the Lord, and this is just me, I think the Lord has designed this thing so that we now have to look really carefully at the word to get to the heart in a lot of places, not all places, but in a lot of places, to get to the heart of what the Lord is saying. But here's something I've noticed. This is subjective personal experience. Once you get it, you look at it, and it's hard to understand how you ever didn't get it. Now it seems so clear. And when I'm studying, I you know, look at the grammar and the original languages a little bit, but I also almost always look at several other translations. I start with the New King James. I always look at the English Standard Version, the ESV. It's the most readable word-for-word translation that we have these days. I always look at the New Living Translation. It's a paraphrase. So the interpreters take the concepts from the Bible, and instead of trying to match word for word, they try to catch the sense and write it down. But see, that in itself, what if you take it in a direction that the Lord didn't intend? I mean, that's very, very possible. So that's the danger of a paraphrase. But, you know, a lot of times you kind of go back and forth, and you can see how they relate, and most of the time it's okay. And then if you really want to stretch, and I read everything that I'm studying in Eugene Peterson's The Message, which is like a paraphrase of a paraphrase. It's almost Peterson's private interpretation. And I have to be honest and say there's a lot of times where I'll read a passage and I'll read The Message and I'll say, boy, did he miss the boat. I mean, what in the world does this have to do with this? You know, he really, you know, like he took a paraphrase and then reinterpreted it to mean something else and then kept doing that until finally the end result doesn't hardly relate to the original at all. But when he hits it, man, it's a home run out of the park. And Peterson just happened to hit this passage in John, just bullseye, right on the money. And he makes it so clear what Jesus is saying. But again, I think the reason that it's, for some of us, for people like me anyway, the reason it's as difficult as it is to really get to the heart of it is because it's supposed to be. You know, that whole business about throwing pearls before swine. And how many times does Jesus say, he who has ears to hear, let him hear, eyes to see, minds to comprehend? I don't really think that this is supposed to be clear to the casual, you know, reader without the indwelling of the Spirit and without the intent of really finding the heart of God's truth. I think that this whole difficulty is intentional. So I read these things, and especially the words in red, and you know, they ask a question, and then Jesus gives an answer which doesn't seem at first to have anything to do with the question. You know, are you a Samaritan and do you have a demon? Well, I honor my Father. What? Well, when we watch, you know, the dots don't connect for me. At first, we weren't talking about who honors who and how and why. We're talking about, are you a half-breed? Are you the chief of demons? You know, we're calling you names, basically, is what it amounts to. And he comes back with, nah, you know, it's like, I don't have a demon. But I honor my Father, and you dishonor me. And what Jesus is getting to here in this whole passage, and it's just my first point here, but it carries through the whole passage, what Jesus is telling these guys is that all of this that you disagree about, all of these things that you don't understand and that you're fighting against and you're digging in your heels and you're just resisting as hard as you can, this is all designed by God to give him glory. The very God that you claim to worship is here being glorified, being lifted up, you know, amplified, and you're fighting the whole thing. And he wants them to see that. That word glorify, you know, again, it's not a word we use very often in common conversation. In the Bible, we usually associate it with the Hebrew word Shekinah, and you might pronounce it Shekinah. I don't think God minds, you know, which way you go with it. You say tomato, he'll say tomato. But the idea of that at its core has to do with the idea of light. Just, you know, it's hard to describe God, so that we just can come close. In a few times, we're given things, you know, God is love, God is truth, and God is light. And it's the idea of light kind of emanating from God's person or, you know, God's substance, however you say it. Emanating, you know, the light, like the cloud by day, fire by night, you know, and the glory of God would descend in the tabernacle, you know, and it was that idea of the light. Remember, Moses went and talked to the Lord and was exposed to that glory, that Shekinah glory, so much so that his own face began to glow, and he had to wear a veil over his face just so people would talk to him. It just kind of rubbed off. So that's the literal part of glory. I think when it comes to giving glory to God or glorifying God, we might just turn that idea around to make it simpler for us. And I think of it as shining the spotlight on. You know, shine the spotlight on God with, you know, with your words, your actions, your worship, whatever. You're going to glorify God. That means you're going to shine the spotlight on him. That's not a literal interpretation, but I think that's a good picture of what that whole thing is about. And he says, you know, this is all about God being glorified. I honor my Father, but you dishonor me. And I don't seek my own glory. You know, I'm not in this for me. There is one, you know, the one who seeks and judges. But most surely I say to you, if anyone keeps my word, he shall never see death. I think what Jesus wants us to understand here is that his motive, Jesus' motive in his birth, his death, his resurrection, his ascension, in his mission, was not about receiving honor and glory for himself. It was about bringing glory to and honor to the Father. That's literally what he says. I'm not in this for my own glory, but there is one. You know, that's the one who should get the glory for this. What we're seeing here in a roundabout way, or I guess if you have eyes to see and ears to hear. This is humility in action. Jesus just stands there boldly. He's not threatened by them. What's the worst thing they can do? Kill him? They're going to do that anyway. He knows that's coming, as he knows the resurrection is coming. So he just stands there, and he's not chewing them out. He's not yelling at them, and he's not calling them Samaritans and half-breeds. And, you know, he's not going there. He's just kind of telling them, look, I don't seek my own glory. You know, God's the one who gets the glory. Humility in action is being comfortable enough in your own skin and confident enough in who you are to God that you can tell it like it is without your own ego getting in the way. Wouldn't you just love to be able to develop that skill when you're talking to skeptics and doubters about God, whether they're people from another religion or people that are no religion, or, you know, people who know it all and think you know nothing, and their family members? I mean, we're coming up on Thanksgiving here, you know, in a few days, and I, you know, there's been a lot of arguments around the Thanksgiving dinner table about God. If you can't talk about politics, you know, you slip into, let's say grace. Say grace. You're going to talk to yourself. You're going to pray to a myth. You know, and then it's always, you know, the brother-in-law or the cousin-in-law's second neighbor twice removed. And somebody makes a stink and you're there. Well, what do I do? You don't know anything. What you're talking, no, I can't do that. That's, you know, that's not a good witness, I guess. That's not how I want, you know, that's not how Jesus conducts himself. And you say, well, I'm really sorry to disagree with you, but, you know, there's a pretty good possibility that just maybe you might be a little bit off track here. Now you don't have to dance around it and be all apologetic. You know, it's humility. You're comfortable in your own skin. You're confident in who you are before God. And you know there's really no threat. They can't hurt you. You just tell it like it is. You know, and God said, don't worry about what to say. I'll give you the words to say. Jesus was so practiced at saying no to the flesh and yes to the spirit that he was able to keep the focus on God even when the skeptics tried to put the focus on him. How about that? That's a skill to have. You know, that's a great skill to develop. What he implies here in the verses to come is simply, it's not about him. You know, Jesus never sang, it's all about me. It's all about me. Yeah, he never went there. Now, it's true that, you know, the Father glorifies the Son, but everything the Son does is to glorify the Father. And you know, he says, it's not about me, it's about him, because God is doing something wonderful. Then to God be the glory. That's the first thing. Then, the next couple of verses, because God is doing something wonderful, we don't need to worry about death. That's one of the great benefits of knowing God, of being a follower of Jesus, is that you don't need to worry about death. Look at the next couple of verses. Most assuredly, I say to you, verse 51, if anyone keeps my word, he shall never see death. And then they said to him, now we know you have a demon. Abraham is dead and the prophets are dead, and you say, if anyone keeps my word, he shall never see death. Are you greater than Abraham? He's dead. The prophets are dead. Just who do you think you are? And again, Jesus turns around. Look, if I honor myself, my honor is nothing. It's my Father who honors me, of whom you say he's your God. Our rescue from the power of sin, as accomplished by Jesus' life, death, resurrection, and ascension, is for the glory of God. Now, that's one of the things I hope to talk about next Sunday night at communion, so I'm going to leave the meat of that idea for now. But just remember, our rescue, our salvation, it's not for our benefit. We benefit from it, but that's not what it's all about. It's not for Jesus' benefit, although he definitely gets honor and glory and praise and worship, and he's due every bit of it. Really, our salvation is for the benefit, for the glory of God, that God receives the rightful glory. Now, their point here is that Abraham died, the prophets died, you know, Moses died, David died, Solomon died, they all died. How can you say that he who obeys my word will never see death? Are you greater than Abraham and the prophets? Who do you make yourself out to be? Well, you know, as a matter of fact, he is. He is greater than Abraham and the prophets. He's the one they prophesied about, even when they didn't know it. I don't think when David wrote, you know, his visage will be so marred you won't recognize him as a man, I don't think he saw Jesus' face or Jesus literally hanging on a cross, although it's a really good description of crucifixion. Crucifixion hadn't been invented, wouldn't be for a few hundred more years. But he didn't see the specifics of it, but you know, under the inspiration of the Spirit, he just that's who he was writing about. We now, with 20/20 hindsight, can recognize that was all about Jesus, you know, the suffering servant in Isaiah 53. Isaiah's long gone, but Isaiah, you know, who was pierced for our transgressions? Jesus. Now, Jesus, at his time, looking back on those scriptures, recognizes his own self. Out of Bethlehem, Ephrata, the virgin will give birth, and I will call my son out of Egypt. And just the prophecies just line up until finally, over a period of time, you know, with his prayer life and everything else about who he was, he came to recognize this is about me. And surely Abraham and all those other people recognized that, even if they didn't have the specifics. And what he says here about you shall never see death, you're familiar with that verse, you know, where, O death, is your sting? Talking about for believers. Well, the death of the body for a believer is a transition that has no sting. Now, we're always afraid of the unknown. It's like going into surgery. They were rolling me into surgery once, and I was looked up at the nurse, and I said, is there any way not to be a little nervous right now? And she said, no, probably not. You know, they're going to go in there and they're going to do embarrassing things to your body and you're going to be asleep the whole time. And, you know, there's no way to not be nervous about it. And there's no way to look, you know, to try to look beyond this life and just not be a little, you know, anxious about the whole thing. But we have the promise here that there's no sting, that it's not something believers need to be worried about. When a believer breathes their last, closes their eyes for that last time, we immediately enter into a timeless existence in the presence of the Lord, reunited with believing friends and family from our past, and ultimately will return to earth with the Lord, never to die again as God's plan for eternity unfolds from one adventure to the next. That's pretty wonderful. And so Jesus says, you know, fellas, if you'll just, you know, listen to what I have to say, keep my word, is what he says here. And keep means obey, but it also means protect. You know, hold it dear, keep it safe, hold it to yourself as a precious thing. My word, what word? Well, God so loved the world that whoever believes in him should not perish, receive eternal life. If you live by that, even more importantly, if you die by that, then just, you know, escaping the confines of this restrictive tent is actually pretty cool. It's actually something you want to look forward to. Because God is doing something wonderful, we don't need to worry about death. And the third thing we need to understand in this passage is that Jesus lived and died to accomplish the most wonderful thing that God will ever do. Do you understand what a big deal your salvation is? I wonder if we do sometimes. I mean, we might, you know, we get a little taste of it. We don't know whether to laugh or cry or lay down or jump for joy or whatever, but most of the time, I think just when we kind of wander through life, you know, even as followers, I think we just lose sight of what a big deal our salvation is. I talked about the idea, the fact that Romans tells us the earth itself aches for God to finish what he started. The Bible tells us that the angels, these invisible created beings, they long to look into these things. What in the world? I mean, the angels are the ones who, you know, are around God's throne saying, holy, 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 and still they go, what in the world is he up to? You know, I wish I understood what he was doing with these little two-legged fuzzballs down on earth. You know, what's up with this? And the entire spiritual realm beyond what we can imagine. You know, there's that story in the Old Testament where Elijah and Elisha, and their eyes were opened. You know, they were facing a very dire situation, and their eyes were opened to see what was hard to describe. It looked, the best they could come up with was, you know, thousands and thousands, a multitude of soldiers on the hills surrounding them, ready to go fight their battle, when they thought it was just, we're just the two of us are in this. And however big that invisible realm is, we kind of have to invent an image of it, you know, which may or may not be accurate, but that whole realm is just going to stand there, you know, going, when I finally see what God has been up to all this time. Now, Jesus tells us that Abraham had a little glimpse of it. Your father Abraham, you know, your ancestor Abraham, rejoiced to see my day, and he saw it and was glad. You know, they're claiming to be, well, it's all because of Abraham. We're good to go as far as God is concerned. He says, well, gee, you don't believe what Abraham believed. You're not doing what Abraham did. You're actually, you know, he rejoiced in my day. You're trying to kill me. How, you know, what's exactly is the benefit of this Abraham thing? Again, it doesn't really make sense. When God told Abraham, and this is, you know, Genesis 9, 10, 11, 12, actually 12 is probably where this hits the money. He said that one of his descendants would be a blessing to the whole world. Abraham, you know, one of your descendants. Your descendants are going to be like, remember, Abraham didn't have any descendants at this time. God said, you're going to have so many descendants, it's going to be like the stars in the sky or the sand at the seashore. But one of them, out of all those, is going to be a blessing to everyone, everywhere, throughout all time. And it's unlikely that Abraham in that moment saw a manger in Bethlehem, or a cross at Golgotha, or an empty tomb. But he simply believed God. And because of that faith, God said, in effect, God said, Abraham, you, with all your faults and flaws and failures, are as good as perfect to me. Because of your faith, Abraham, in spite of your sin, and sins were many, grievous, heavy, but because of your faith, when I see you, it's as though you are perfectly righteous, without sin of any kind. And that's the model for us. Flaws, faults, failures. Well, maybe a couple of you, but the rest of us, you know, have it all together. No. We're all losers. You know, left here at our best, we're filthy rags. But because of our faith, because of our utter confidence in God's willingness and God's ability to pull off what he's promised, which for Abraham was in the future. For us, we get to go back in the past. We don't have a DVD, we don't have a soundtrack, we don't have the movie, but we do have a pretty good account of all that went down there and how it literally turned the world upside down and continues to turn our lives upside down. Because of our faith, God sees us as righteous, as perfect, as without sin, without blemish. See, the wonderful plan of God's is timeless. 57, the Jews said, you're not even 50 years old yet, and you've seen Abraham? You know, it's like, come on, dude. Abraham died a long time ago, and you're like 33 and you're telling us you've seen Abraham, and here's the, you know, this famous statement, most assuredly I say to you, which I think in modern English would be Jesus saying, hey, look, man, before Abraham ever was, I am. I am that word from the burning bush. Who shall I say sent me? Tell him, I am. This is the second or third time just in this chapter that Jesus has used that phrase. Second or third time in this conversation. Unless you believe, I am. I am all there is. I am all you'll ever need. I'm all there ever could be. You know, I just am. And you don't need to describe it any other way. There aren't enough words. I am. That settles it. That air you're breathing, I am. That light illuminating the book, I am. Your ability to read, to think, to reason, I am. Your existence, I am. The planet you exist on, I am. The solar system, the universe, the stuff that goes way beyond what the Hubble telescope could ever see, I am. I just am. Before Abraham was, I am. See, God's plan to do something wonderful didn't begin in the first century. Didn't begin with the birth of Jesus or the death or the resurrection of Jesus. It began from eternity past. It's always been God's plan. Now, sometimes it seems like God is doing something just awful. Doesn't it? The stress and the strain of life in this fallen world, it can seem like too much to bear. It really isn't that hard to get to that point, but there's a part of you. There's a part of you that God designed into you that knows that this isn't the way things are supposed to be. We don't just want to be free. There's a part of us that knows that we ought to be free as creatures made in the image of God. We know that we ought to be free from suffering and pain and death and loss and misery of every kind. But when it all comes to a conclusion, we're going to look back at the misery, all the misery of our earthly lives, and it'll be like the Bible says, it'll be like labor pains, you know, unbearable at the time. I can't do this. You don't have much of a choice, you know. And then suddenly, slip, slide, slurp, boop, there she is, there he is. And then suffering, what suffering? It's the most joy I've ever experienced in my entire life. And it'll be the most joy you'll ever experience until the next time you go through the same thing again. Suffering and all. You know, 9 months of walking like this. You hope it's not in the summer, you know, because it's really miserable when it's hot out. But man, after that baby's born, you put him in your hands and you're just going, you know, pain, what pain? Suffering, what suffering? God's doing something wonderful in the world, in Tootle, in each of you. And when we let that sink in and don't let it get drowned out by all the noise and the nonsense that's going on around us in the world, in the family, in politics, in the weather, whatever, we begin to see just how wonderful God's plan really is.